Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, Janie Scott, author of A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. And what she gave her son can be described in this sentence, which she told him, and Janie makes reference to early on in her book. If nothing else, I gave you an interesting life. And indeed, she did just that. Janie has done a whale of a job reporting here, spent a lot of time talking with people who knew Obama's mother, spent a great deal of time in Indonesia to get a full understanding of the kind of work that his mother was doing in that part of the world. Janie was a reporter for the New York Times from 94 to 2008, and then she went on leave to write this book. The book also includes an interview with the president about his mother. In 2007 and 8, she reported and wrote a half dozen long biographical articles on then-Senator Obama as part of a Time series on the lives of the presidential candidates. She was a member of the Times team that won the 2000 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. I know that many of you are reading this book right now because it has been receiving rave reviews. And quite frankly, because a lot of us wondered about his mother, that he made more reference, I think, to his absent father than his mother. And she indeed had an interesting life that our guest has documented so well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Hello, Janie. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
Great. Everybody loves this book. It's wonderful that you did all of this work because we've been wondering for years now, what about his mom? What about his mom? And you decided to do something about it, and that's good.
Well, you're right, Kathleen. She's always been characterized as sort of one of a number of oversimplifications, you know, the white woman from Kansas,
yeah,
or in the campaign, the single mother on food stamps, or the woman who died young of cancer. And in fact, while there's some truth to each one of those and the various other oversimplifications, they have served to obscure an utterly fascinating story of a thoroughly unconventional life.
Yeah, thoroughly unconventional. And I love the quote when you talk about the unconventional life she gave her son. If nothing else, I gave you an interesting life. That's for sure, isn't it?
Right. And it captures something wonderfully self-deprecating in her sense of humor.
Exactly. I want to go to Indonesia first here, because you've done some really deep research about the kind of work that she was involved in. And it was really top-notch research. She was totally involved in the Indonesian culture. And it rubbed off, I think, in fairly significant ways on the now president of the United States.
That's right. She moved to Indonesia in 1967 when she was in her early 20s, and her son Barack was just 6 years old. She had her second marriage was to an Indonesian student at the University of Hawaii, who she met shortly after her first marriage to Barack Obama Sr. had broken up. And he returned to Indonesia, and she followed him in 1967 in a period of enormous political and social upheaval in that country. She lived there for 4 years, or actually 4 years with her son, who she then sent back to the United States at age 10. Then she went back and joined him, and then returned to Indonesia when he was in high school so that she could do her field work for her anthropology PhD. She had decided to become an anthropologist. So then over the course of really the rest of her adult life, she spent more than half of her time in Indonesia, first doing her scholarship, her field work for her dissertation, which was working in small villages studying handicraft industries and cottage industries and their role in as a sort of survival strategy for poor families. Then she went on to become a consultant in international development, working on development projects in Indonesia, including in the area of small credit programs. Then she worked for the Ford Foundation for 4 years in Jakarta as a program officer, and then returned in the late 80s and was the anthropologist on staff for one of the largest government-run commercial banks in Indonesia, Bank Rakyat Indonesia. which at the time had the largest self-sustaining commercial microfinance program in the world, which was really quite extraordinary, because this was in the very first years of the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, which subsequently won the Nobel Prize in 2006 for their work in that area. So she was really in on the ground level at this, in this work of making very small loans and small savings accounts available to relatively poor people in large, large numbers all over this country, which happens to be the fourth largest country in the world.
Mm-hmm. What was it she found so absolutely captivating about Indonesia?
Well, people who've spent time there and worked there understand that entirely. And I made two long trips to Indonesia working on this book, and I got a glimpse of it. It is an absolutely remarkable culture and place. It has very deep, complicated history and cultural mixing. You know, Hindu, Islam, Chinese, you know, Christian, and the whole mix of influences in the culture. Many, many wonderful, you know, sort of 10th, 9th, 8th century temples. Really an interesting artistic culture that is very lively even today. So I think, on one level, for anyone going there, it's fascinating. It's also physically fantastically beautiful. It's an archipelago of hundreds and hundreds of islands, many of them very different. There are something like 350 languages spoken, because there are so many different cultures that have been traditionally isolated from each other. But I think also, in addition to what it would be like for a person who's just an ordinary tourist, there's an attraction. But for her, she was an anthropologist, and anthropologists have always been fascinated with Java in particular, because of the persistence of these traditional ways of life and traditional artistic occupations that really serve a very central role in daily life there. The people that she studied were making things like, you know, iron tools for agriculture and fabric for Indonesian clothes, things that are used in everyday life. They haven't been reduced, as they have in many developing countries, to sort of tourist activities. These are central to daily life there. Mm-hmm. So it's just a fascinating place, both for anyone and also especially for an anthropologist.
Mm-hmm. Would it be a stretch to say that there is such a thing as Indonesian cool, and that our president learned that as a half black kid from the ages of 6 to 10 in Indonesia?
Well, yes. I wouldn't say it's a stretch. I think it's probably a factor. Whether it's the only factor, who knows? You're referring specifically to the culture of Java, which is the most populated and populous island in Indonesia, and a large source of Indonesian culture in general. And in Java, there really is a sort of ethic of self-control. To express too much, to show your emotions too much, is perceived as a sign of weakness. And one of the ways that this is inculcated in young people is through a culture of teasing. So children are teased about all sorts of things, including skin color in particular, hair texture, body type. And it seems from the people who remember them there that President Obama as a child experienced teasing on all those grounds. When I was doing the research for this book, I interviewed a woman an American woman who had been in Indonesia at the same time as Ann Dunham, the president's mother, and the young president. And she recalled having lunch with them in the city of Yogyakarta in 1971 when the president was 9, and going out for a walk afterward, three Western women and the African-American child of Ann Dunham, and how a group of Indonesian children ran alongside them and started throwing rocks at him and taunting him and calling out racial names. And Ann didn't really react to this, Obama's mother. And this woman who was telling me the story said she was surprised by that and wondered if Ann had understood what was being said. When she offered to intervene, Ann said, "No, no, no, he's used to it." And this woman's interpretation was that Ann was raising him to have this kind of ability to rise above these affronts and to have a kind of emotional fearlessness. And many Indonesians think that that's really, since he was there between the ages of 6 and 10, a rather impressionable period, and he was in enrolled in Indonesian schools, that that's one of the places he learned that sort of disarming cool that many Americans find a little bit baffling, you know, how he could, when confronted in, you know, campaign debates or in struggles with Congress over various things, how he doesn't seem to sort of blow his stack the way we Americans expect he might.
Yeah, I've always found that astounding. My background is Irish, so I tend to fly off the handle at times. But the whole thing about Donald Trump and the birth certificate and that movement that kept going on and on, how he could hold his cool during all of that instead of just lashing out at these people and letting them have it was just astounding to me, Jenny.
Yeah, I think many people who haven't been exposed to that kind of a culture find it quite foreign, but I think there's some truth to the fact that if you're experiencing that when you're young, and his mother was like that too. She really was not, I'd say, I heard very few stories of her blowing up, or that she really, her ethic was to attempt to understand the other side and to contain one's response, keep it to oneself. She was actually quite a private person.
Let's talk about his, it struck me, or maybe it was just the concentration of the book, that she spent a lot more time with her daughter than she did with Barack Obama, that he was sent back to Hawaii when he was 10 years old, that she was very proud of him and wrote to him. But in terms of day-to-day contact, or even month-to-month contact, it was Maya who was with her much more than Barack Obama. For those of us who are moms or grandmothers, the thought of sending your child so many thousands of miles back home to be with your mother, which is okay, but to not be able to raise your child must have been really hard. Can you talk about why she made that decision and if she regretted that decision ever?
Yeah, I do think you're right that a lot of Americans find that really hard to understand. The circumstances were complicated, more complicated than I think we generally give her credit for, although I wouldn't say everyone would arrive at the same conclusion. He was 10, or about to turn 10, and she was in a country where education was not good at that time, and she didn't have access to an English language school because really the only one that was available was very expensive, and you had to be affiliated with certain foreign institutions to get your child in. So she came from a family that cared deeply about education. Going back for many generations in Kansas, her forebears had been teachers and educators, and while her parents did not complete college, all of their siblings did. Three of the four went on to graduate school. Two ended up with PhDs. This was a family that really,
I guess,
valued that. In fact, going back to the Oklahoma Territory, in some branches of the family, every son was being offered the chance to go to college. So this was something she felt deeply, and her mother and father both felt strongly about. And she was frustrated by the fact that he was being educated in not very good schools and in a language that he was not comfortable in, and she really believed that for his long-term future plans, he would need access to a great great English-speaking university. So she wanted him to be educated so that he'd have a chance of getting in. So she made the decision, as you point out, you know, to send him back by himself halfway around the world to live with her parents, who happened to live a couple of blocks from one of the best schools in Hawaii. She trusted her parents. They had been very helpful to her early on in his life, and they had the same values, and so she did that. She then joined him, was with him for middle school, and then left again when he was about to enter high school because she had finished her graduate coursework, and if she wanted her PhD, which she considered essential to doing the kind of work that she wanted to do and being able to support both what she then, at that point had two children, being able to support both of them, she felt she needed a PhD in order to get those kinds of jobs. So according to the president, he also, at that point, agreed that in high school he'd prefer to just stay in Hawaii in the school where he was, which was a very good school, and he was doing very well in. So she went back and was working on her field work and then also began working in international development. And as you pointed out, wrote to him regularly and saw him on vacations. But yes, he was living with his with her parents. Now, the only thing I would suggest is to be borne in mind is that a lot of expatriate families who were living in Asia at the time didn't educate their children in those places. They sent them back to boarding schools in England or wherever. There was no tradition in her family of boarding school, so she did what I'm assuming she thought of as the alternative within the culture of their family, to have him live with her parents and go to a very good school.
And what about her daughter? How did she educate Maya?
Maya, as you pointed out, had a very different childhood. Her father was Indonesian, and Anne, at the time that she sent Barack back to Hawaii, was married to an Indonesian man, therefore, and had a half-Indonesian child. So picking up and moving to the U.S. was not so clear an option. Maya was homeschooled till almost her teenage years. Anne taught her, and also through various collections of parents, many of them Western, in the places where she was working, they would put together homeschools in their houses or in their garages for educating their children. And Maya also spent a lot of time with her mother in the field. She recalls vividly, going and spending a lot of time with blacksmiths that her mother was studying. Her mother's dissertation ended up focusing on peasant blacksmithing, which is iron working done in backyard forges by largely male iron workers. And Maya has, vivid memories of that and going to places where batik was being made. So she had a very close, intimate relationship with her mother. Then when her mother was at the Ford Foundation, she had access to the Jakarta International School, a very good English language school in Jakarta. So Maya went there, and then for high school, Anne moved back with Maya to Hawaii so that Maya could go to the same school that Barack had gone to, Punahou. So she was with her for her whole childhood. So it was a very different kind of experience. And I think it really had to do with the fact that Maya had a real reason to be in Indonesia, in that her father was there and she was half Indonesian. It was less clear why Barack should be there.
Yes. And was there something that she saw in her son that was extraordinary, and she saw it early on, and did she talk about that?
She did see something she thought that was extraordinary. Many, many people remembered her saying from when Barack was very young, that he was so bright, he could be anything, and to some people, she said, including president. She had enormous confidence in his talents, and she worked to cultivate those things. She expected of both of her children a very serious commitment to education. She wanted them to develop a very strong work ethic. She also told a friend of hers that she wanted Barack to come of age with the values that it had taken her years to acquire, that it had taken his mother, years to acquire, that she wanted him to have a strong sense of the importance of working for the benefit of other people, that the greatest thing one can do with one's life is create opportunity for other people. And when I interviewed him last summer, he said that that message really underlay his decision to go into public service. So on this sort of big part of life, one's values, he credited his mother with the ones that had really shaped him.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think he purposely, it must have been purposely, didn't talk very much about her and wrote this book, that Dreams of My Father, that really concentrated on a guy who was, well, quite frankly, terrible to him?
Yeah. It is interesting because it seems almost that there's more judgment against his mother than there is against his father, and yet his father's the one who was basically absent the entire time. But I'm not saying on his part more judgment, but by the public. I think part of it comes from the circumstances out of which that book arose. It was proposed to Barack Obama shortly after he had been elected the first black president of the Harvard Law Review in 1990. And an agent had contacted him in the wake of a series of articles that had appeared in major American newspapers about the first black president. And if you go back and look at those articles, which I did, you see the beginnings of the telling of the Barack Obama story that we all came to know in 2004 after the Democratic Convention, and in 2008 during the campaign, the white mother from Kansas, the black father from Kenya. And the story, the articles get longer and longer over the course of these months. And obviously some of this is just the selection of the reporter who's writing the article, but they increasingly focus on the story of the father And in those articles, Anne is usually, his mother is a white woman from Wichita, or his mother is an anthropologist in Indonesia. Just a very simple one-line thing, which she actually commented to a friend of hers about at the time and said, I was reduced to a single sentence or something along those lines. But I think because the agent approached him at that moment when he was being hailed as, you know, the first black president of,
right.
of this elite institution, the book, therefore, was really about him grappling with his racial identity. And in the United States, that meant grappling with the part of him that was black. So that's the way the book was. That kind of framed the story, and then it got followed forward. The second thing is, I think Anne Dunham's story is so complicated and contradictory and challenging, really, to think about, and the choices that she made about raising her child, the way she chose to live as a woman, as a professional, as a single mother raising multiracial children at a time when that was much less common. I think that's a hard story to summarize briefly in a way that you would, say, in a political campaign or in talking to voters. It's just difficult to capture the nuances that way, and so therefore it got reduced to almost nothing.
And there are so many nuances, as you so well explore in your book, being just an anthropologist in Indonesia. Oh, there's a lot to being an anthropologist in Indonesia, really, isn't there?
There certainly is, and it's a foreign concept to any of us. I mean, any of us who happen to have been anthropologists or traveled to Indonesia, what does that mean? Just to explain it the fascinating thing I found about her life was that these decisions that seem so surprising when plucked out of the context, when you embed them in the context of her life, they make so much sense. You know, and even, I don't think, I make the point in the book that I do not believe that she was a visionary or, you know, a saint of any sort. She was fantastically human, and I mean that as a compliment. She kind of improvised her life, and yet each one of these decisions did connect to the previous one. You know, she conceived a child at 17 with an African at a time when nearly two dozen American states had laws against interracial marriage. Well, that kind of event, decision, whatever you want to call it, accident, whatever it was, that is going to change the course of your life.
Right.
And she goes from there to a relationship with an Indonesian student because she's become interested increasingly in the world beyond Hawaii or beyond the United States. She then moves to Indonesia and she gets interested in local arts. She was very interested in arts and crafts. She had been a weaver herself. And that kind of leads to an interest in the lives of those people, which leads to her field research, which leads to her interest in credit and the fact that lack of access to capital was kind of holding people back, which leads ultimately to microfinance. So it makes sense when you put it all together, but the little details pulled out of context are pretty baffling.
Janie Scott, our guest this hour, her book is A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. We welcome phone calls for Janie. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You could send an email to that address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Janie Scott, our guest, and the book is A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm going to go back to racial identity, because what you said is so extraordinary, and I think about this fairly often, that she did have this child with a man from Kenya and then a child with her husband from Indonesia. So I'm wondering what her thoughts were about racial identity and what she taught her children or what her children learned from her as the result of these interracial marriages and living in the places in which they lived.
You know, Kathleen, my sense is that Anne did not spend a lot of time talking about racial identity. I think she lived the example that race to her was kind of interesting detail, but not particularly central. Now, maybe that is the privilege of a white person in a society that privileges white people, but I get the impression that while she made an effort to have her children understand their racial history and respect the cultures of the country that they came from, and that those cultures and those histories were deeply woven into their childhoods. I don't think it was kind of plucked out as a thing to dwell on, talk about, impress certain lessons, because it was just she was living it as though it wasn't. These distinctions could easily be crossed, and that there wasn't it wasn't the kind of barrier that a lot of us think of it as, or certainly did then. There's some indication from the people that I spoke to that she might have felt a little bit. It's difficult to find exactly the right word to capture this, but there was a close friend of hers who also worked with her in Indonesia later in her life, who told me that Anne had a slight feeling of wistfulness, as he put it, not exactly a sense of rejection, but a sense of distancing when her son chose to root himself in Chicago, get increasingly involved in Chicago politics, and identify increasingly as African American. That was not really the way she had. That the experience of his childhood, and that wasn't really kind of the way she thought of him. And she had a feeling, as I say, that according to this man, that he was putting distance between her and him. So clearly it was there as an issue in their relationship, according to that anecdote, and it's hard to imagine it might not, that it wouldn't be. But I think it was more, her perspective was, why do these things have to be quite so important? So I think that's how I would characterize it.
Yeah, and I think she taught him that as well. It doesn't seem to be all that important to him. Although, and you write about this, at one point when he meets Michelle and moves to Chicago, he establishes more of a black identity. Am I reading you right by reading that she was a little bit, felt a little slighted by that?
Yes, I think that's what that anecdote suggests, according to that person who was, as I say, very close to her, worked with her, actually lived in the same house with her. So I have no doubt that she indicated that to him.
And what about the kind of racism that she experienced when she married Barack Obama Sr., when she had a child with him? Did she experience any of that? Didn't people think this is a very unusual thing for a white person to do in this time in history?
They must have. I don't have a lot of detail about the exact experience that she had at that time. However, I do know that her relatives in Kansas, many of them didn't even know about this until long afterward, in some cases years afterward. A cousin of hers, actually a uncle of hers who was closer to her age than the previous generation, told me that he didn't know about it till 3 or 4 years after Barack was born. And so I think there was some discomfort about sharing this within the family, which suggests there might have been discomfort beyond that as well. On the other hand, the thing to remember is that this took place in Hawaii, a state that at the time, as now, had no racial majority. There certainly was not a majority white population. Very, very diverse society, very proud of its diversity.
Yes.
And while there were not very many African Americans in Hawaii at the time, there was so much mixing going on. And then on top of that, they met at the University of Hawaii at a time that the university was opening up in a very bold, interesting way to Asia and bringing in a lot of foreign students. And to some extent, you see it on the campus at that time that the biggest sort of energy and interest at the time was really in this new influx of foreign students and the mixing of West and East. And so I think it's, again, when you look at it in context, it's a little different. I think it was probably easier to do that in Hawaii than most American states at that time, but I'm sure it was not easy.
Mm-hmm. And recount for us again the marriage between Obama Sr. and Stanley Ann Dunham, and how long it lasted, what drew them apart, and how she kept alive his memory in her son's mind.
Well, they met, as I said, in 1960. She was a 17-year-old freshman at the University of Hawaii.
So young. She was just a little kid.
Exactly. And she was out of her depth. I mean, she had been transplanted there by her father against her will when she graduated from high school in Mercer Island, Washington. She had wanted to stay and go to the University of Washington or possibly the University of Chicago, but her father felt she was too young to be kind of out of his reach. So she, in her first weeks at the University of Hawaii, encountered Obama, who was the first African student there. He had been there for a year before her, so he was a little more known and a little more comfortable and at ease, probably, in that environment. And she, as I say in the book, whatever happened, happened very fast, because by early November, it seems, she was pregnant. She dropped out of college, married him quietly, and gave birth in Hawaii in August of 1961. And almost immediately, the marriage appears to have ended. Whether it ended even before the birth, I'm really not sure. But she subsequently learned that not only that he hadn't originally leveled with her about the fact that he was actually married to a Kenyan woman and had a child back in Kenya and another child on the way. When she actually learned that, I don't know. But also, I was told by a close friend of hers from graduate school, to whom Anne had told the whole story, that Obama's attitude toward her seemed to change radically when they married. And this woman recalled a story that Anne had told her of preparing dinner for him one night and him looking down at the plate and saying, "You expect me to eat this," and picking it up and hurling it against the wall.
Oh.
And her realizing at that moment, according to her friend, that this was not going to work. I think she was sort of swept away. You know, she was, as I say, 17. According to her high school friend, she'd never really had a boyfriend. She, according to her graduate student friend, she was a virgin at the time. So I think she really just had this kind of cataclysmic encounter and was, in some ways, way out of her depth. Obama was much older than her. He was sort of formidably intelligent and opinionated and quite domineering. And I think she really was kind of overwhelmed. The interesting thing you mention is that for years afterward, despite the fact that their marriage blew up and he went off to Harvard and then returned to Kenya and really almost never saw her again, despite that, she worked very hard throughout Obama's childhood, and he describes this very well in Dreams from My Father, to create in his mind what turned out to be a somewhat idealized image of his father. She didn't allow whatever bad things had gone on between them to really taint their son's view of his father.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Jannie Scott is our guest this hour, author of A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Karen in Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I'm driving, so I'm just going to pull over.
Thank you.
I was living on the island of Borneo around the same time that Barack Obama's mother was in Indonesia. I was in the very northern part where it did not belong to Indonesia. It was part of Malaysia at the time. But this is a wonderful program for me. So much of what was going on, I think, for young women in the United States at that time was to try to find opportunities and a place to grow intellectually and so forth in the very beginning of the women's movement. I was in Borneo from 1963 to 1966. And to be honest, I was in a relatively small city. There were more opportunities there for adventure for me than there were in the United States at that time. And I can really understand the pull that she had for that part of the world. A Caucasian woman in Southeast Asia had many more opportunities for all kinds of interesting experiences. And I can very much understand why she decided to send him home when he was 10 years old to live with grandparents that she trusted. It would be very difficult. Many, many expatriates would do the same thing because they wanted their children to have an education that would serve them as adults, not just as children. And I can also see why President Obama is the kind of person that he is. I've read in other places that where you are when you're about 9 or 10 years old has a huge influence on who you become and on your outlook on the world. And I was 21 when I was there, but the whole outlook on how people live together and how they deal with difficulties and how they deal with each other in a very diverse culture is so different from here. And I can understand now, after hearing parts of this program, why when he became an adult living in the United States, he felt forced almost to choose, am I white, am I black, I have to choose. It's not like Southeast Asia where lots of people are mm-hmm. lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just enjoying this so much.
Thank you, Karen.
I'll hang up and go on my
and
way.
Get on the road again.
Listening on the radio.
Thank you very much. Your comments were really good. Jannie.
Yeah, Karen, I really appreciate that. That was fascinating. I was very struck by Karen's point that many young women were looking for just that kind of adventure and experience in those early years of really pre-women's movement. I was very interested in the fact that in Anne's high school class, quite a lot of her friends, but male and female, went into the Peace Corps. She graduated right around the time that the Peace Corps, that Kennedy was running for office, and the Peace Corps, the idea of the Peace Corps surfaced. And so she, while it wasn't the majority of the class by any means, there was a small subset of sort of brainy, curious, slightly nonconformist people like herself who chose that, who really wanted that kind of adventure at a time when many Americans, looking back, think, oh, that's the end of the 50s, it's kind of quiet, nobody's looking for that sort of thing. But you really see sort of the beginning of the 60s in years well before the sort of classic capital S 60s.
You know, and you think about those years and a lot of young women and young men going into the Peace Corps and having those kinds of incredible work experiences and adventures. It's one thing to do it as a single person. It's quite another thing to do what she did with two children and
yeah.
being a single mom for most of it.
Yeah, she really is sort of a forerunner in that way. She was a single mother as a graduate student at the University of Hawaii when, according to pretty much everyone I interviewed, it was very unusual to be married and have children. Far more unusual, and also be a graduate student, far more unusual if you were a woman. Unusual to be a woman graduate student anyway, unusual to be to have small children and then to have multiracial children with two different fathers. This was an extremely complicated life at a time when most graduate students were focused simply on, you know, their work and the sort of theories that they were addressing and their social lives. Whereas she was, as it was described to me by one friend, she had been an adult for a long time by the time she was sort of in her late 20s and early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, she goes into a profession, several professions that really are dominated by men. Her research was in a, particularly looking at a craft that was entirely a male domain, peasant blacksmithing. Then she goes to work at the Ford Foundation when there are very few, if any, single mothers doing this kind of work. And then she goes on into international, she goes back and forth in international development, which has traditionally been male-dominated. So, yes, in many ways, she was sort of taking on triple the normal load.
She sure was. Eli is our next caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Eli.
Hey, good morning. How are you today?
Okay, how are you?
Fine, thank you. I just had a quick question. I was wondering if your guest could expound on the entire birther issue and as to why so many Americans might believe that the President of the United States was not born in, where he says he was born.
Sure, I'll take that on. The birther issue, as you know, started during the campaign, so I was aware of it when I started working on this book, but it kind of went underground for several years until Donald Trump really brought it back recently. It seems pretty clear to me. I did, of course, look into this, and it's been obvious since 2008 that the standard Hawaii birth certificate, which is the, what people now call the short form, but that is the one that Hawaii gives out for anyone who asks for their birth certificate, that had been given out in 2007 to the campaign. It had been on the website since 2008, available for anyone. It had been, its existence as authentic had been confirmed by Republican as well as Democratic elected officials in Hawaii. It had been investigated and its authenticity confirmed by numerous organizations, nonpartisan organizations, including factcheck.org. And yet the issue came back, and people did profess to have some doubt about his birthplace. And so, as you know, he released the quote, long-form birth certificate, which is not the standard Hawaiian birth certificate. As for why, I'm not an expert on this, but it seems to me that it's pretty well accepted that it's a classic conspiracy theory, and it feeds on information that should put it to rest but doesn't, because those who believe in conspiracy theories believe that any evidence to the contrary is simply further evidence of a conspiracy.
And thanks very much for the call. Let's talk more about, I think this was a friend you referenced. You had interviewed a lot of people who knew her. And she was described by many as a very outgoing, outspoken person. She worried about the pressure for Indonesian girls to be passive and accommodating. There were others who worried about the influence of Indonesian machismo on their sons. She would tell her daughter not to be such a wimp. She didn't like this passive Indonesian female caricature. She would tell me not to fall into that. Can you talk more about that? And we talked about the bullying that Barack Obama received. Was there also an influence for him to be this kind of tough guy? And she tried to counter that in some way.
Well, she definitely wanted her children to be strong. I don't think machismo would probably have been her choice, and I don't. I know that there's some a better source on this is probably Dreams from My Father, in that there's some scenes that are described there between Obama and his stepfather Lolo Sotoro, in which Lolo Sotoro is teaching him, I think, to fight, as I recall, but you know that there was some influence there, and but I don't. I've never heard that it was something that she felt driven to try and counter in him, that he was becoming too macho.
Mm-hmm.
But she, yes, she when she, you know, she was always from a very young age. She had a mind of her own. She was didn't tend to fall with sort of the dominant thinking either at school or ever. She always sort of fought about things for herself and was not ever hesitant to express her opinions. And upon arriving in Java, this was somewhat counter to aspects of Javanese culture in which opinions are often not expressed. They're expressed only by indirectly. And her bluntness was very striking. This woman who you quoted, who was also an American living in Indonesia, married to an Indonesian, was telling me that Anne was sort of refreshingly blunt in a way that, interestingly, Indonesians accepted because she was a foreigner. They just figured, yeah, well, she's just different. We don't hold her quite to that the same standard of discretion or whatever. But not that she was lacking in discretion; it's just a different kind. But she was pretty outspoken and really made a point with her children of wanting them to be free to go off on their own and do something important with their lives. I think at the end of her life, she was relatively alone because she had created these very independent children.
Right. More phone calls momentarily. Janie Scott, our guest this hour, her book, A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have a few lines open if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. June in Toronto. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, June.
To start off, I have very much in common with Barack Obama's mother. in that I married a West African. But on the other hand, I had so much more going for me in terms of my family and of his family. And we were married for 33 years until he died very sadly at a very young age, at 59. And we both shared the same profession. We're both economists. And there is culture, time when you have to get adjusted. And I found people very accepting and very, very kind. And my mother-in-law came to live with us about, a year after we moved to the place where we lived for a long time. And she was wonderful. And when I went to get my master's, she took care of my son, and neither of them spoke the same language. And when I came back, they were both speaking. She was a wonderful woman who had five children, two of which had PhDs, one of which was head of an administrative hospital, nursing hospital, and one in business, and another one who did very well in her business, and she was what they call illiterate, but she was not at all unintelligent to have raised such fine children. And I think my parents, being non-prejudiced, especially my father, who accepted everyone, and my in-laws being very responsive to our marriage was helpful.
Thank you, June. And we should talk about her parents and how accepting they were, and what was the origin of that?
Well, her parents, even though the stereotype might make one expect them to be having been less exposed to this sort of thing, not so open to it, they actually were somewhat unconventional themselves. Their Anne's mother had, though Maya described them as in many ways polar opposites, Anne's mother had done a number of things that are not unlike the decisions Anne made. She had married at 17 in secret a man who her parents didn't like, Stanley Dunham. And then as soon as she graduated from high school, they announced that they had already gotten married, and they headed left Kansas and went straight for California. They were people who were not content to remain in the small towns in which they'd grown up, and they were interested in a wider world. And they moved around a lot when Anne was a child. And the president's description of them is in several ways quite interesting, in that he says that his grandfather, Stanley Dunham, felt a certain amount of empathy for the experience of black people in America because he felt that he had been subjected to a certain amount of prejudice himself, not having had the right kind of class background or style or appearance or whatever to please the parents of Madeline Payne, the woman that he married, or to feel like he was fully accepted in the small towns in Kansas where he'd grown up, that he had felt there was a certain shared experience. Similarly, they ended up moving, to Hawaii, where a much more diverse society. And so I think they were open to this in a way that the notion of two people from small town Kansas might suggest that they weren't. Similarly, I also heard from Madeline, Anne's mother's sister, Arlene, that Madeline and Stanley, the father, were quite taken with Barack Obama Sr., that they were impressed by him, and they were interested to hear what he had to say. They were a little bit in awe of him. He was, a pretty impressive person in a lot of ways, very, very intelligent, very well-spoken, had this sort of slightly British accent. And according to Arlene Payne, she really got the distinct impression in the time that she spent with them together that her sister and Stanley were somewhat taken with him. Hmm. So I think it was not as clear-cut as one would expect. Nevertheless,
their daughter was 17. She dropped out of college. They believe very important in college, very much in college education. And so I think they also hope that whatever this was going to pass. And it, in fact, did, because the marriage ended so quickly.
Yeah. One more phone call. We have about a minute left. Chuck in on the road. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show. I'm responding to something, a question you asked your guest a few minutes ago about the role of Ann Dunham in helping the president adjust to his racial identity or giving him insights. And during the campaign, I simply remember, and I think it's cited in the book The Bridge, which I read a while back as well, he was asked something about how he succeeded, that is, Barack Obama, how it succeeded in a dominant white culture. And he cited three pieces of advice that I gave him, and they were, in order, smile, always be polite, and don't make any sudden moves. Now, I may have read too much into that, but I'd like to hear what your guest
has to say about it. We have about 10 seconds, if you could do that, Jim.
That's actually in his memoir, and he describes it a little bit sarcastically about a strategy that he had figured was going to work with white people. What he described to me as his cynical adolescent self. So I think he knew that that tended to work, and he tended to play that as an adolescent. I doubt that he would say that's his view, his total view on the question.
Jenny, thank you so much. Thanks for doing this book. It's much appreciated by so many people. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathleen. It was great to be here.
Jenny Scott is author of A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. And we thank Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Be with you again tomorrow.